Coming up on Athens News Matters, inside the push to get commercial air service in Athens.
We know that the people are there. You know, we just have to market it well. Let them know that we're here when an airline does come.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Alexia Ridley.
And I'm Chris Shoup. Also today, the making of compostable plastics and a UGA expert on the coronavirus outbreak.
One thing that we need to understand about this is that it is a new and emerging infectious disease, and I think that's very important because the science is changing on a day-to-day basis.
Those stories, plus...
Wine is wonderful. It is history. It is psychology, philosophy. It's science, lots of science.
We bring in our resident sommelier just in time for Valentine's Day, coming up on Athens News Matters. The news is next.
Some things you don't really have to question. If you want to believe the dog in that viral video was cooking spaghetti, you go for it. But how your decisions this November will affect your community, that is worth really thinking about. On your NPR station, you get reporting that informs your decisions and challenges what you think you know, because some things are worth that extra mental energy. 2020 election, it's time to listen.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News. I'm Alexia Ridley.
And I'm Chris Shoup. Commercial air service in Athens has come and gone over the years, and now a group of business and community leaders say it's time to bring it back. WUGA's Jessica Wurst reports.
Ask just about anyone who lives in or around Athens. Flying can be a pain in the neck. Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport is over an hour away without traffic. Parking can be a nightmare. And once you're actually in the airport, get ready for hours-long lines. The hassle of flying out of Hartsfield-Jackson is just part of living in Athens, at least for the last 12 years or so. But what if there were another option? Athens-Benepps Airport is a short drive away from downtown. Parking is free, and only four people were in the building when I visited on Monday. It's quiet. So quiet, in fact, that you can hear a coffee maker brewing and the automatic doors opening and closing. The last commercial flight out of Athens was over a decade ago, but newly renovated facilities and a freshly paved runway might change that. Airport Director Mike Matthews is working on a new strategy to incorporate passenger services to Athens-Benepps. A big part of his plan depends on a $750,000 grant from the Federal Aviation Administration, which could be approved later this month. If Athens-Clark County gets the grant, Matthews hopes to attract the top-tier air carrier, like American Airlines.
We're looking for airlines that really are based, you know, in revenue and are quality, you know, that already have, you know, a good revenue base that can sustain themselves.
For coming to Athens, the airline will receive free rent for a year, free landing fees, and other aid for initial costs. Matthew says that these incentives will be able to sustain this service, especially since filling seats will be easier this time around.
There's 1,400 people per day that fly in and fly out, and all we need to capture is just 7% of that in our market to make it work. So with that said, we know that the people are there. You know, we just have to market it well, let them know that we're here when an airline does come.
But the commercial flights out of Benepps would initially go to Charlotte, North Carolina, not Atlanta. Still, Charlotte is a hub for American Airlines, with an airport that can connect you to pretty much anywhere on the globe. Jason, an Athens resident waiting on a shuttle to Hartsfield-Jackson, says he'd still rather fly out of Athens.
It would depend on where I'm going, but if it's somewhere in the southeast, probably rather fly there from Benepps.
Russell Edwards, District 7 Commissioner and Board Member of the Downtown Athens Business Association, is optimistic.
There's a need for this, you know, and if we want to really take our economy to the next level in terms of scale and productivity, it's hard to imagine how we do that without a commercial airline at a certain point. So I think it's a noble effort. We got to keep pushing for it.
Athens-Benepps is the oldest airport in the state. It housed Georgia's first pilot, and Matthews intends to keep the historical aspect of this community pillar even as it grows.
Now, we are conscious of the community. We're not going to be a Hartsfield. You know, we're not going to bring in a lot of noise or anything like that. But we do want to be the best airport we can in our community. And I'm excited about being here.
Mike Matthews says he's hopeful that the Small Community Air Service Development Program grant will be approved and expects to receive an answer by the end of this month. Commercial air service in Athens has never been a particularly successful proposition. Attempts in the past have eventually fizzled out, but Matthews, Edwards, and other airport boosters say the recruitment of a nationally known carrier could be the difference maker, and Edwards says that this is a battle worth fighting again.
You know, maybe in the end it doesn't work out, but it's worth a shot, and at least we're out there selling Athens as a great destination and a place to do business.
For Athens News Matters, I'm Jessica Wurst.
Last week, the World Health Organization declared the coronavirus outbreak a global health emergency, which recognizes the risk the virus poses beyond its country of origin. Since then, world governments have made significant efforts to contain the disease, including closing overseas offices and restricting travel to affected countries. Here to talk about the outbreak is Kurt Harris, director of UGA's Institute for Disaster Management. Dr. Harris, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Well, to start out with, I think we all are well aware of the coronavirus, but let's begin by what are the symptoms, how is it transmitted, things like that.
So I guess to start off with, one thing that we need to understand about this is that it is a new and emerging infectious disease, and I think that's very important because the science is changing on a day-to-day basis.
Wow.
So when we think about the origin of where it came from, we're actually not 100% certain. We're fairly confident that it came from a seafood market or an animal market in China, but we're not 100% certain about that. So we're still learning about that, and we're still trying to pinpoint the evolution. Again, same with kind of symptoms as well. We're still learning about that, but primarily what we're seeing right now are fever, lower respiratory issues, so cough, things of that nature. But in more severe cases, we're also seeing pneumonia.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's a lot that can be read into the statement global health emergency. Tell us a little bit about what that really means to, say, us in Georgia.
So when we think about a global health emergency, you know, obviously this originated in China, but we're starting to see it, and now we've seen it in 28 countries as of today. So we're definitely seeing cases that are branching out beyond China, but it's important to note, too, that the overwhelming majority of those have been travel-related.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where we're really starting to see some of the regulation come in as we're looking at travel restrictions and travel bans and so on. So we've only seen just a few cases of human-to-human transmission globally, but again, 27 countries outside of China have now seen this virus.
So with over 400 dead and over 20,000 infected in two dozen countries, there's talk that this outbreak might become a pandemic. Tell us what that really means and how it would change how governments might respond.
So what that really means is you start to see it more widespread in many countries. So predominantly, if you look at the amount of infections that have occurred, about 20,000 of those are actually in China. So still the overwhelming majority are there. But again, every day as you turn on the news, we're seeing more and more cases that are popping up in various countries all over the place. So if we start to see more of these human-to-human transmissions outside of travel-related, then that gives us a much different posture of what we're looking at from a healthcare point of view, and so on.
Right, right. So let's just say, and hopefully this is not the case, but let's say there's an instance of the virus here in Georgia or even right here on the campus of UGA. How would the IDM respond to it? Would the Infectious Disease Transport Network, which we reported on back in October, would that come into play?
So definitely. They will definitely be involved, as well as just the Infectious Disease Network in Georgia. So the transport network is a component of the bigger network. So we're thinking about all of our primary care clinics. We're thinking about urgent care clinics. We're thinking about hospitals, all of these different groups who would be coming together and ultimately responding to this event. But I think it's important that we always talk about just good public health practices. So you kind of equate this to what flu looks like right now. So little things like washing your hands and making sure you're doing that for 20 seconds with warm, soapy water. Or if you have an alcohol-based solution for cleaning your hands, ensuring that it's at least at 60% of the alcohol content. It's also doing things like sneezing into your elbow, recognizing your own signs and symptoms so that you're isolating yourself from healthy individuals. All of those things. So we as citizens have a huge role to play, because if we're recognizing those things and we're seeking immediate medical care, then we have the ability to help stop this from spreading.
Is it the still relatively unknown specifics of this that make it really scarier than the flu? Are they really kind of on the same platform, if you really get down to it, or is it just this unknown that's really scaring folks?
So I love that question. I think it's an excellent question. So if you look at the United States right now, there are currently 19 million cases of flu. That's what we've dealt with so far in the U.S. just in 2020. So when you equate 19 million cases of flu, and we've only had just a handful of cases so far of coronavirus, all but one of which has been travel related. So when you put those into context with one another, it's still good public health practices. So the same thing that we do for flu are the same things that we do for this coronavirus right now.
Right. Well, one last question. What role does the CDC and the Institute for Disaster Management play in international outbreaks, just in general?
So the CDC is mainly from... they put out a lot of guidance. So they're not necessarily a regulatory body, but they do put out a tremendous amount of guidance that the rest of the world views and takes almost as kind of gospel, if you will. So they are putting out their recommendations. They're putting out a number of things as it relates to personal protective equipment, how you protect yourself, what are some of the good practices that are out there. And they're constantly learning and evolving. So again, we don't have vaccines for this new coronavirus right now. We don't have antivirals for this new coronavirus right now. But they are currently working on them, not only by themselves, but with other clinicians and researchers that are around the world.
Fantastic. Kurt Harris is the director of the Institute for Disaster Management and an associate professor in the College of Public Health at the University of Georgia. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News.
My name is Gabe Vodica, and I'm a managing editor at Flagpole. We've been partnering with WGA for several years. Flagpole's been around since 1987. It's the exact same year, so that's a reason we feel a bit of a kinship, WGA. We definitely want to support WGA and its mission, and we feel like there is quite a bit of overlap in the public radio listener and the potential Flagpole reader in terms of what they're looking for and the kind of issues they're engaged in the community. Find out how you can become an underwriter by emailing wuga@uga.edu.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News. I'm Alexia Ridley, and joining me now in our studio to talk about the week in news and politics are panelists Lee Shearer from the Athens Banner-Herald, Blake Odd from Flagpole Magazine, and Aaron Schilling from the Red and Black. So thank you all for joining me today. And we're going to start things off with emotions running high at the most recent commission meeting. Lee, do you want to start us in on this?
I'll do my best. There's a group that's organized around the removal of our black neighborhood back in the 1960s through urban renewal called Lennontown, roughly where Brumby Hall and Pressel Hall are now. And residents have organized with the help of some folks over at the University of Georgia and are demanding that the Athens-Clarke Commission sign a resolution condemning those actions and terming those as terrorism. And talking about the institutions of white supremacy. And about 50 of them came to the commission meeting to protest and to speak to the commission. And emotions were pretty high at times.
I know, Aaron, you work not too far from there. So you're very familiar with that. And I know you have, you know, a little bit about some of the history of that area as well.
Yeah, so I thought it was interesting because while this happened in the 1960s, I had never heard of it until a couple months ago. And the group has been very organized, has put out a whole website citing the history of Linen Town and stuff like that. And on MLK Day, they had a protest at City Hall in which they also spoke about the redress of Linen Town. And this one was also very emotional. You could tell that everyone was really engaged in the redress for Linen Town and very passionate that they wanted the university and the city to address this and actually do something about it.
And Blake, you're always our resident historian. What can you add to kind of flesh this out?
Well, this is not the only neighborhood that happened to in Athens. There were multiple African-American neighborhoods that were raised during urban renewal. And I mean, it's a terrible thing that, you know, there and so many of these urban renewal projects, I mean, all over the country, you know, had similar effects where, you know, neighborhoods were raised for sports stadiums and, you know, freeways cut right through the middle of neighborhoods and, you know, people being pushed out and displaced. So, you know, I've spoken to several of the commissioners about this, and I think everyone is sort of generally on board with doing something. The dispute seems to be more about the wording of this resolution, you know, where some people think it's probably too strongly worded. And I think that's a valid point, because if you're going to get the University of Georgia to come to the table, I think, you know, calling them terrorists is probably not going to help accomplish that. But the resolution itself doesn't do anything. You know, they have other demands. They have, you know, specific actions that they want taken, like monetary compensation for the former residents of Linen Town, and I think a scholarship fund set up, and a museum of racial history or institute of some type. And, you know, those are the more tangible things. Passing a resolution, it doesn't get those things accomplished.
Yeah, I would be interested to see if UGA would support the resolution if the wording was changed.
I think that's a very good question. I would wonder that as well.
Yeah, because I know some of the commissioners said that they would, if the wording was changed, they would give their support. But I don't know if UGA would feel the same way.
I also wanted to touch on the fact that some intrepid Cedar Shoals reporters broke a really interesting story. New board member Antoine Stevens was reported to not actually be a Cedar Shoals high school graduate. So I'm very impressed with the fact that these students did this story and did a very good job with the story. And your thoughts?
They did do a very good job. And they discovered that Antoine Stevens, the newly appointed member of the Board of Education, had said he was Cedar Shoals class of 2014, which was cited as a reason to appoint him, being a recent graduate of our local public schools. But he actually didn't graduate from Cedar Shoals. And now he says that he graduated from an online school that he attended because he has had some health problems. But he may not even have graduated from there, is the latest I'm hearing. So there are a lot of other issues going on. I've been looking at some of his old campaign finance reports, and he had been running for Congress even though he's too young to be eligible, and he had raised a lot of money off Twitter, being retweeted by people like Alyssa Milano, who has millions of followers on Twitter. And, you know, he hasn't filed a lot of the paperwork that he's supposed to file. He ran for mayor a couple of years ago and filed one disclosure that said that he had raised over $100,000 and then never filed any more. You know, he didn't actually wind up running for mayor, and no one knows what he did with that money. He's legally supposed to keep filing these reports until the money is gone, but he hasn't done that. So we don't even know if he actually raised this money, or if he did, what he's done with it, which is against state law. That's a violation. So still a lot of questions out there about this guy.
One interesting thing is you do not have to be a high school graduate to serve on the Board of Education, the board president pointed out.
That's right.
But that's hardly the issue.
You know, it's interesting because Erin and I were talking a little bit before the show, and you raised that, the qualifications for school board members.
Yeah, the board qualifications are not very extensive. You don't have to be a high school graduate. You have to be 21. You have to be a citizen. So there's not really a lot of, like, specific qualifications. And then the board said that they did their due diligence in vetting Stevens because he signed an affidavit saying that he had all of the qualifications. And that was, they said, the only vetting process that they have.
You know, a lot of the stuff we're talking about would have, you know, it wouldn't have taken a whole lot of work. They could have done a Google search and found out a lot of this stuff in about 5 minutes. But nobody did, apparently. So here we are.
And he will have to run for his seat this year.
That's right. In May, there will be an election. He's filling out the rest of the term, which runs through the end of the year, but there's going to be an election in May.
So in somebody who is not running for election this year is the district attorney, Ken Malden. He resigned this week. He sent a letter to the governor.
Right. He's resigning effective at the end of the month, and he had said he was not going to run for re-election, but that he would finish out his term. Now, resigning means that the governor will appoint his replacement.
Which will not be Deborah Gonzalez.
Which will not be Deborah Gonzalez, who is the progressive Democrat who's running for that seat. And in fact, apparently there's a quirk in state law, and this is the first I've heard of this, but if Governor Kemp sits on the appointment for a few months, then Brian Patterson, who's Ken Malden's chief assistant and who is also running for district attorney, would become the acting district attorney, and the election will be pushed back from this year to 2022, so there would not actually be an election this year. Which means that Deborah Gonzalez could not run for district attorney this year because there would be no election.
That's interesting to know. I did not know that.
Yeah. So, you know, I don't know what the motivation for all this is, but, you know, that is a scenario that could play out.
That's what it makes you think about, manipulation of the voting process.
Brian Kemp manipulating the voting process. Imagine that.
All right. That is our time for this week. Thanks to my guests, Blake Aud, Lee Shearer, and Aaron Schilling. On January 31st, a group of reporters broke the news that Antoine Stevens, the newly appointed Clark County Board of Education member, did not graduate from Cedar Shoals High School as he previously implied. But this story didn't come from Flagpole or the Athens Banner-Herald. Reporters at Cedar Shoals High School beat all the other publications to the punch. Jackie Wright and Stephanie Gayona Perez are two of the journalists who broke the story. And thanks for joining us today, guys.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
So, Stephanie, how did you put this story together?
Basically, Jackie attended one of the board's meetings, and that's how we kind of became aware of Antoine Stevens being appointed. After hearing he supposedly attended Cedar Shoals High School and graduated in 2014, they then decided to look in the yearbook and in the graduation program. And when we looked, we didn't see his picture in there. We didn't see his name in the graduation program.
Yes, so first we were just curious about what he was involved in school and maybe who his classmates were, and we couldn't find him. And so that just led to more reporting, and we contacted him.
Tell me what happened when you contacted him.
We just asked him about if he graduated and when he attended, and he told us that he didn't graduate from Cedar.
And as you said, you guys are looking at yearbooks. I guess it makes sense. You're in high school. You know, hey, let's look and see what he did in high school, what clubs he might have been a part of. Were you looking for those sort of things?
Yes, we were originally.
And as individuals within the school system, how do you feel about the current climate of the school system and the school board?
Well, it's important to us because we're students and they're making decisions about what happens in our school and what will happen for students that attend after us. So we want the members to be as honest as possible with us and with the community, and we just hope that they can do what's best for all of the students of Clark County.
And adding on to what Jackie said, prior to becoming a student journalist at Cedar Shoals High School, I wasn't too interested in what the board was doing, but now realizing how much it affects our daily lives as students, it made me more aware, and I now I'm trying to get to know each individual board member, and what I really want is honesty.
That's also why we're making an effort to improve our coverage of the events at board meetings.
Mm-hmm.
We would also like to ask listeners to check out our website, cedarblueprints.com, where we have this article and lots of other features and news pieces regarding our community.
Also, we're a student-led publication, so every article, everything on our website is produced by students. All the ideas come from students, which I feel like is really unique and gives off a different perspective of Athens.
You know what? Maybe we can have you back on the show.
We would love that.
Great. Thank you again for joining me.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jackie Wright and Stephanie Gayona Perez are student reporters for the Cedar Blueprint at Cedar Shoals High School. This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News.
My name is Morgan Fry, and I am a recently graduated master's student in journalism at Grady College. The project that I'm most proud to have contributed to while at WGA is definitely the StoryCorps Athens project. I feel really honored to be one of the few people who has listened in entirety to these StoryCorps stories, and it really helped me feel more connected to Athens. Learn more about WUGA internships at WUGA.org.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News. I'm Alexia Ridley.
And I'm Chris Shoup. I want to say one word to you, just one word, plastics. They're everywhere, and as we use more plastics, they're piling up in landfills and in our oceans. But there might be hope for a more eco-friendly plastic. WUGA's Megan Wan has this story.
Making biodegradable plastics isn't a particularly noisy affair. Machines whir and buzz, notes are taken, textbook pages turn, and sometimes you hear the occasional crinkling of plastics. At the University of Georgia's New Materials Institute, researchers are testing various materials to develop alternatives to single-use plastics that aren't just biodegradable.
More importantly, they're compostable.
That's Evan White, one of the researchers at the New Materials Institute. White says the term biodegradable encompasses any material that degrades and fragments into smaller pieces as a result of other life forms.
And that's not what the consumers expect with biodegradable. They want something that just returns to nature.
So, if you're environmentally conscious and worried about the explosion of single-use plastics, what you really want are compostable materials, ones that are biologically degradable by microorganisms and return to the carbon cycle.
You can think about it in terms of a Venn diagram. The larger circle is biodegradable, and then a smaller circle completely contained within that is compostable.
White says that according to Dr. Jenna Jambach of the New Materials Institute, of all the plastics we've ever produced, we've recycled just 9%, and about 79% is just out there, floating in oceans or piling up in landfills. And while there's been a recent resurgence in recycling efforts, no recycling system is 100% foolproof. Leakages and contamination are common. Composting, therefore, presents a viable alternative.
If it's compostable, it doesn't matter where it winds up. Eventually, the earth will digest it. It will return to the carbon cycle.
White and his fellow researchers are specifically developing alternatives to single-use plastics. This can include food packaging and straws, as well as some other unexpected products, such as exfoliants in your makeup or deodorant.
It's amazing what kind of consumer products contain these type of microplastics and these types of non-degradable polymers.
In ideal conditions, such as that of an industrially managed compost facility or an anaerobic digester, these alternatives could compost in between 30 and 90 days. Even in less than ideal conditions, White and his colleagues estimate a compost time of 90 days to a year. The actual development of these materials, however, is taking a little bit longer than that.
It's a slow progress from our own in-house developed materials that's still in development.
The hunt for these plastics is slow, but the research from White and his colleagues is being put to use by industry partners.
So our data is a team effort that we're collecting with our consortia of industry partners to basically push better technology immediately. We can make a few kilograms of materials in the lab, which are great, and they might have a real future several years from now. But if we don't work with the companies today, then we're not going to have that immediate change.
White and his fellow researchers are starting small with their industry partners, but he hopes to broaden this educating to everyone. To White, solving the plastics problem isn't just about the development of new sustainable technologies.
My hope is that consumers are actually going to be educated and benefit the most, because as these plastics evolve and change, as the technology changes, it's the responsibility of us, the chemists and the material scientists, all the way up to the brands and the suppliers that are delivering these technologies, these new pieces of plastic to you, and educating consumers how to dispose of those materials at the end of their life.
For Athens News Matters, I'm Megan Wan.
If you're a freshman under the age of 21, you're required to live on the UGA campus. But there's no rule that says you have to eat in UGA dining halls. Some UGA students are steering clear of the all-you-can-eat buffets of the meal plan in favor of doing their own cooking. Sophie Gratis reports.
At the University of Georgia, thousands of students roll through the five dining halls on campus every day. Along with providing food, these spaces act as major social hubs, where students can get to know each other while grabbing a bite. According to UGA Dining Services, out of the 5,500 first-year students at UGA this year, there are approximately 500 who have decided to forego that traditional dining hall experience.
My name is Cecilia Huynh. I'm a first-year at the University of Georgia, I do see like the advantage of having a meal plan. That experience is a more like conversational meal and like it's more personal. And I definitely think that I'm missing out on that.
While freshmen under 21 years old are required to live on campus their first year, they are not required to sign up for a meal plan. Although these plans might seem like the obvious choice for students who spend the majority of their time on campus, they come at a price. For example, $4,036 a year for the 7-day all-access plan. Here's Cecilia Huynh again.
I'm the oldest of 5 kids, and so it was understandable that money is not something that falls out of the sky.
Due to Cecilia's financial situation, her parents offered to pack meals for her that she could pick up from home each weekend. Her roommate does the same thing. Though the drive takes about an hour, Cecilia doesn't really mind.
It's definitely a blessing, and I'm grateful that I get to have homemade food packed to bring every week. Hearing from my other friends who do have a meal plan, right now they are like getting tired of the food that's offered here, and they also understand like it's unhealthy in a way where they feel like it's not processing well with their body. I can pick whatever food I can at home, and I know what's in the food that I'm eating.
Here's how meal plans work. Freshmen enrolled in one of the 4 residential meal plans use an ID system to get into the dining halls. Through these all-access plans, students can get an unlimited amount of food for either 5 or 7 days a week. Here's Dr. Janani R. Thapa, a UGA professor in health policy and management.
We tend to look for what is convenient to us, and is the price worth the convenience that you're getting?
With convenience in mind, meal plans seem like the obvious choice. But there are other concerns regarding food that freshmen may be considering when they get to college, especially with all-you-can-eat dining halls.
Yeah, freshman 15 is interesting. If we look at the research, there is mixed results. But I do see, you know, maybe the students are thinking there is so much access, I might lose control. But that might apply in cooking at dorms as well. So I don't know how different that would be, though.
Over in Payne Hall, first-year Cherry Gong is cooking dinner. Tonight, it's salmon seasoned with salt and pepper with a side of steamed green beans.
I'm kind of winging it because I usually go grocery shopping like twice a month because Payne is not as a social dorm as like the high rises, so it's much harder to meet people. So I met a lot of my friends through other freshmen cooking.
Cherry also decided against a meal plan when she got to college. Instead, she cooks meals in the basement of her dorm, where students have access to a stove, oven, and a community fridge. She says her budget for groceries is about $80 a month, since she takes advantage of deals and discounts at places like Kroger and Walmart. This budget brings Cherry's cost of food way below the average cost of a meal plan. But this doesn't result in a limited diet. Back in September, Cherry launched an Instagram account, Cherry Tries Cooking, in an effort to self-motivate in the kitchen. Colorful plates of ramen, dumplings, omelets, and a variety of tempura cover her timeline.
I started trying to make my food prettier. A lot of the times my food might get cold because I've been like trying to take pictures for like 20 times. It just motivates me to like start cooking every day. And I like sometimes cook for my roommate or like I cook for my friends.
While Cherry's family could have afforded a meal plan, she says a healthy diet and more controlled eating schedule makes cooking her preferred option.
Because I feel like dining halls are basically like a buffet where you can eat whatever you want. So I think in order to eat healthier, it's better to cook by yourself.
Dr. Thapa again.
I have been to dining halls myself, and I think they do a lot to try and provide healthy meals. But I can see where self-control might play in, and students have access to desserts, students have access to, you know, unhealthy choices and be over-consuming. If there are students who know how to cook and doing it, then that's a good trend.
Access to enough healthy food is essential. And for students who may be struggling with this, UGA provides resources, such as a food pantry, cooking classes, and food scholarships. But one thing is clear, one size does not fit all. Freshman year will come and go, and while some students will leave with memories of late night trips to Snelling, others may have learned how to make the perfect scrambled eggs. For Athens News Matters, I'm Sophie Gratis.
Statistics are a big deal in our day-to-day life, even if we don't often think about them. They play a role in our weather forecasts, our car insurance rates, even whether the grocery store down the street has the flavor of potato chips we like in stock. A University of Georgia statistician is questioning the role of a bedrock concept, statistical significance, in scientific studies. That professor, Nicole Lazar, sat down with Alan Fleury in this excerpt from the podcast Unscripted. Here's that conversation.
Why did the premier journal of the statistics discipline choose to take on the issue of probability values?
There's been a perception of a reproducibility and replicability crisis in science, and some people were attributing this to misuses and abuses of statistics, and so we felt that it was a good time to come in and talk about it and try to steer the conversation maybe in a better way.
What do we mean by replicability?
So there's reproducibility and replicability. Those are both terms that get used, and they mean slightly different things. So I think for the most part, when people say reproducibility, they mean that if I give them my exact code and my exact data, that they will get the exact same results as I did. Replicability, I think, for the most part, is interpreted slightly differently, and that is if I run a similar study, it doesn't necessarily need to be that I have your data, but I do a similar study to try to study the same phenomenon or related phenomenon, that I would get consistent results to what somebody else got. So they're very related to each other, but they're not exactly the same thing.
So we're talking about scientific experiments, clinical trials.
Yes.
The way people glean results from their experimentation.
Yes.
They judge the relative meaning of their results based on their probability value.
Yes, and that's part of the problem. So the p-value has become sort of a gatekeeper of what results get published even, so what can make it into a journal, and what results are considered to be important or interesting or even real. And that's a role that it was never meant to have.
So the term statistical significance, it seems to have a couple of potential meanings, and yet it also has some power to undermine science at certain points.
So the people who first came up with these notions of significance testing, hypothesis testing that are so common in science nowadays, they themselves said any kind of threshold that you might use shouldn't be the same for all situations. It should be context specific. Any one study should not be determinative. You should have a preponderance of evidence from different studies pointing to a similar conclusion. And significance at that time also meant something a little bit different from what it means now. So now we think about significance as meaning important, but it didn't used to mean that. It just meant something that maybe was worth noting. Something that was significant was maybe worth another look, another study, but it was not taken by any means to be determining, oh, this is truth.
For the regular person in the public, how do we think about p-values?
That's a really good question. And we've been struggling a lot with this over the last year, certainly. Scientists have been really actually quite helpful in this because they all have stories of, you know, clinical trials or some kind of experiment that looked like it was really interesting and it had some results that could have been really important, but because it didn't hit some arbitrary threshold, never saw the light of day.
Mm.
For instance, medicines don't get approved because somebody did a trial and the p-value was not less than 0.05, and so it doesn't get approved. Think about the effect size and what does it mean in terms of lives saved or years added to quality of life. Translate it back into real terms that people can understand, and then from that decide whether there's a real meaningful effect or not.
Well, because the need has somewhat exploded. I mean,
yes.
From finance to politics, people want analysis.
Yes.
There's data about everything.
Everything, absolutely. And so, you know, I always tell our students from undergrad up through grad students, this is a great time to be involved in statistics because there are so many problems. There's so many different types of data. Anything that you're interested in, you can find some data about to analyze.
What does it take to be a good statistician?
Skepticism.
Well, that's very important, but please expand on that.
So actually now all my students laugh about it because they know that the first thing out of my mouth is going to be skeptical.
Nicole Lazar is acting head of the Department of Statistics at the University of Georgia, and she spoke with Alan Fleury, host of the podcast Unscripted with Alan Fleury, available wherever you get your podcasts. This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News.
Hi, my name is Rachel Hopkins, and I'm the marketing coordinator for Athens-Clarke County Transit. Now that our fare-free categories include senior citizens, people with disabilities, youth, Athens-Clarke County government employees, and UGA students and staff, it makes it even easier to explore the benefits of having a public transit system. One of the reasons people love Athens is it's a small-town community that offers major benefits, like public transit and great public radio. To learn how you can become an underwriter, email wuga@uga.edu.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Chris Shoup.
And I'm Alexia Ridley.
Okay, you shouldn't need a special day like February 14th, for example, to show your significant other you care about them. So let's be clear, this is not a Valentine's Day story.
But just in case you are planning a little something special, like a home-cooked meal, in the next week or so, we've brought in our resident sommelier, Krista Slater from The Expat, to give us a quick lesson in wine. Thank you so much for joining us today, Krista.
Oh, I'm happy to be here.
So tell us first a little bit about what does a sommelier do?
What we do is we select the wines for the list to pair with the food that we're serving for y'all that night, and also to navigate the list for those, just to kind of not only pick the best wine to pair with the food, but also with the person ordering.
And tell me a little bit about your background. How do you get this job?
Yeah, I started off working in the art history world.
History, wine.
Yeah, there's actually more in common with it than people might think. It all comes down to being a curator of an experience. Wine is wonderful. It is history. It is psychology, philosophy, it's science. And my job, I am no scientist. Like I said, I have an art history degree, but that makes me very well qualified to tell stories and backgrounds. But my background, I started back in the early 2000s. I went out to culinary school in Northern California, and I became a sommelier in 2006 through the Court of Master Sommeliers exams.
You brought a few choices for us here. Let's get into this thing.
So I brought three wines today, a sparkling, a white, and a red. As a sommelier, something I do at the restaurant that's very important is I communicate a lot with our chef about what flavors she's featuring so that I can have a full line of recommendations to go with those dishes. So these are all wines that I would pair with one of our highlighted entree specials for Valentine's Day, which is a langoustine carbonara pasta. So what I brought today is a sparkling wine, Ample de. This is their Armance B Brut. This is a sparkling rosé from the Loire Valley in France. This one has Gamay and Cabernet Franc, which are two red grapes used to make this lightly pink, dry, sparkling wine that is the perfect start to your evening, but would also be a really nice foil to the creaminess of that pasta. And there's no wrong food for sparkling wine, as far as I'm concerned.
How about the proper way to actually taste?
So tasting wine is a full sensory experience for sure. You know, we always go as sommeliers, sight, nose, palate. So starting with looking at the wine, you know, appreciating the color, the clarity.
Which is a beautiful color.
It really is pretty.
It's like a delicate pale salmon pink. So next, the nose is a huge factor. Most of what we get out of enjoying a wine, all those flavors, quote unquote, are actually aromas. So you really do want to spend a lot of time smelling the wine and enjoying that. This is a very delicate, soft, I get like subtle, like a melon, like honeydew melon, maybe a little bit of like strawberries, but like super ripe strawberries.
Mm.
You can feel the little bubbles, a little. Mm-hmm.
It's delicate. It's a little bit minerally in the way if you've ever been next to a river that has lots of stones and pebbles in it, and you smell that fresh water smell. That the reference of minerality to me is part of what makes wine refreshing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We're not just drinking fruit juice. We're tasting all of those different elements that come through.
Well, do we have time for one more, you think?
Absolutely. So we're switching from my sparkling wine from France. And as I said, I kind of cut my teeth in wine in California. So I have a particular soft spot for some of these great, both classic and new California wine producers.
Now this one, what do we have here? It smells a little spicier to me, but I don't really know.
I think that's a great note. This is a beautiful little white wine from a producer named Martha Stauman. She is one of these wonderful new California producers that are smaller, but that are really kind of doing some unique
and delicious wines and are doing it in the right way. So this is her wine called Honeymoon. This is a beautiful white blend. This wine is mostly a grape called Colombard. So she always blends it with a little bit of another varietal. So this white also has a small, about 15% Chardonnay this year, which is one we all know well. To go back to you saying it was a little spicy, I always get a little like candied ginger on this wine, kind of. So again, going back to our langoustine pasta, carbonara, this is, seems like a easy pairing.
So as you get ready to serve us the red, there seems to be possibly a misconception that the older they age, the better they are. And talk a little bit about that and as far as what it really means.
Yeah, so short and sweet, age ain't nothing but a number.
There you go.
It's a case-by-case basis. There's so much subjectivity with what you enjoy. It's also case-by-case based on how the wine is made, what it was built to do. So I don't think it's in terms of good or bad. It's just what's your end goal with this wine. So speaking of young versus old, I actually brought this red is another California favorite of mine. It's Brock Cellars, and this is their Love Red. This is a wine that is built to be youthful and fresh. And so this is a red that is a blend of grapes, mostly Carignan, with a little bit of Valdiguie, Syrah, and this is the 2017 vintage. This one had a little Cabernet in it. So what I like about this red is the old school tradition of like, oh, red with meat and white with fish. This is a red wine that you could do with fish.
Mm-hmm.
Or coming back full circle to our carbonara pasta with langoustines. This would be a really great red to pair with that.
Also has a great color, too.
It's got a lot going on. There's some cherry coming out in there and some flavors I wasn't expecting.
Lots of juicy berry.
Yeah.
No, this has been wonderful.
Yes, this is delicious, too. Just great selections you brought in.
Thank you.
Yeah, I feel like I can actually go order something and have more of a knowledge of how to ask for what I want.
And that's perfect. That's my goal. You don't have to know everything. But if you know how to ask the right questions, I think you'll be so much happier with your experience.
Krista Slater is a certified sommelier who owns the Expat along with her husband, Jerry. And she is now the official WUGA resident wine expert, right?
Correct. Yes.
Yeah. And for more information about the wines we discussed today and more about wines that are available at the Expat, you can go to theexpatathens.com.
You've been listening to Athens News Matters from WUGA News. Martin Matheny is our senior producer and Gemma DiCarlo is our associate producer. Our segment producers are Jessica Wirst, Megan Wan, and Sophie Gratis. The opinions expressed on this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of WUGA or the University of Georgia.
Don't forget, you can hear all of the segments from this week's show and our past shows online at WUGA.org, as well as on the WUGA app, available for Apple and Android, wherever you get your apps. And of course, you can get in touch with WUGA on social media. We're at WUGA-FM on Facebook and Twitter. For Alexia Ridley, I'm Chris Shoup, and this has been Athens News Matters from WUGA News.